This is The Thirsty Developer, episode number 31 for Friday, August 15th, 2008, Patterns with Palermo. Hello, everyone. Welcome to The Thirsty Developer. This is Larry Clarkin. I'm joined by my co-host, Brian Gorbett. Brian, say hello to the folks.
Hello, everyone. Nice to be back again in lieu of Dave still being on vacation.
Yep, you're keeping his chair warm.
I am indeed.
So I had an interesting interview on Tuesday. I was at the Wisconsin.NET user group up in Milwaukee, and Jeffrey Palermo from Austin, Texas, was up with the group. And we sat down, and we had quite an interesting conversation. It was probably the strangest interview I've ever done because halfway through the interview, he started asking me questions.
Nice.
And what's scary is I started answering them.
Hey, as I always said, I think that you and Dave both need to be an interview on a podcast. So it sounds like Jeffrey got half of that at least out of the way.
I was going to say, I would count this at least as half of an interview. But we'll actually book time for you to interview either Dave or I together, or maybe one with Dave and then one with me. So
awesome!
But let's listen to the interview. It's Jeffrey Palermo is a great guy. He took time after we got done at the .NET user group. We didn't sit down until nearly 10 o'clock at night. So we were probably a little bit punchy there, and we had some appetizers together and grabbed a drink and did the interview.
So let's hear it.
Jeffrey, welcome to The Thirsty Developer.
Thank you, sir. Glad to be here.
I'm here with Jeffrey Palermo. Jeffrey, what are you drinking?
I am drinking what's called the Spotted Cow.
The official beverage, the official adult beverage of the Thirsty Developer.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Pretty good lager.
Jeffrey, we're in Wisconsin. You were up tonight at the Wisconsin.NET user group. Thank you for everybody who attended the event. You gave a great presentation on the MVC framework, but it was more than just the MVC framework. It was actually, the title of your presentation was Test-Driven Development, Separations of Concerns, Dependency Injection, about 12 different things, right?
Just three, but yeah. TDD, DI, and SOC with ASP.NET MVC. And I stuck to the acronyms just to make it a tongue twister.
I think most of the people listening to the show will be familiar with you, but let's talk a little bit about your pedigree, as the case may be. You run a very popular blog. You're a Scrum Agile coach. You're the CTO or CIO?
CTO.
CTO of Headspring.
Mm-hmm. Headspring Systems in Austin, Texas.
Yeah, that's a custom software development company, right?
Right. Consulting company in Austin, Texas that we focus on project development that we do with Extreme Programming and Scrum mixed together, do a little bit of Agile coaching and Agile Bootcamp training every 6 weeks or so.
And probably, a lot of people are very familiar with the Party with Palermo.
Well, I hope so. A lot of repeat partiers there.
You keep having it. And for those of the people that don't know, because we have a, big international audience, maybe people haven't been to some of the great conferences like Mix, TechEd, and upcoming the PDC, so they may not be familiar with the party, but just, quickly tell us what it is.
Well, all the details are on partywithpalermo.com, and essentially before, what I'm going for is before every major Microsoft-centric developer conference, have an event called Party with Palermo, and developers can just come out and have fun, have a drink, meet their friends that they probably don't see that they haven't seen since the last conference. And it's the night before the conference actually begins. Usually you're getting into town, you fly in, maybe you're calling or emailing or these days Twittering to find out who's where. And this is just a place where your friends are going to be. People don't come to see me, they come to see their friends. And so it's just a place to meet up. And so I organized that event.
Yeah, Mix 07 was my first party with Palermo. And I have to say that usually the first morning of the conference, everybody's like pumped and energized. There was a couple people kind of dragging, and they kept saying, oh, yeah, Jeffrey throws a great party.
Well, good. Glad to hear it. It started at TechEd 2005 with no budget and just meeting at a hotel restaurant in Orlando. And so it's grown quite a bit from there. Corporate sponsorships cover the budget, the multi-$1,000 bar tab that ends up accumulating.
Wow. So the tab is open the whole night, or?
It's open until the budget runs out.
Oh, okay.
Which, I mean, the budget runs out when the time that most people should stop drinking.
Yeah. And we'll look for that next at the PDC, or do you have another one coming up first?
Yeah, PDC, the night before the PDC starts.
That'll be the October 25th, I think, or something like that. You know,
somewhere around there.
I'm planning on attending, so I really should check that out before I make flight reservations. But
yeah, and then Dev Connections also in Las Vegas.
Okay. And that's falling in December, right?
November,
okay. So with the theme of, you know, Party with Palermo, I thought we would call this podcast Patterns of Palermo. And because I wanted to talk to you about some of the design patterns, you know, that you talked about tonight, but also, you know, in more general terms, what are patterns and how can, you know, we as developers and architects learn more from looking at patterns? So, you know, kind of an open-ended question, what is a pattern?
Oh, gosh. A pattern is a piece of vocabulary, a piece of industry jargon that we use to communicate with each other. So as developers, we have some vocabulary, some jargon that means something that, you know, without the term, it would have taken maybe 100 words to explain the concept. But by saying the pattern name, if, you know, both people are familiar with that jargon, then we can communicate a lot more efficiently.
So the, you know, by analogy, I think a good simple example would be like, oh, you know, Jeffrey, we should really do that as a singleton. You know, because you know what a singleton is, and I know what a singleton is, that we've, you know, kind of both lapsed onto it. And more importantly, we can go look up and get the official definition of what a singleton is. And then we can both, you know, make sure we understand and talk about the same thing.
Yeah, and there's some of these patterns that are that have a common definition across the industry. You know, the Gang of Four is pretty well known, those patterns in there. But even within your team, you could have patterns that everyone on the team understands, and maybe no one except the developers in your company have ever heard of the term. But it's still useful because within the team, within the people you work with every day, you can say that term, and that communication is meaningful.
Yeah, one of the best definitions I ever heard of pattern was not from a software architect or developer. Dr. Michael Hammer, who's famous for process engineering, actually came up with a set of patterns for process reengineering. You know, you want to do things. And he said, you know, it's deja vu, you know, hitting you. If you felt that you've done this several times before, you have. It's a pattern.
Right.
And it's something that, you know, you ought to, you know, fine-tune and adopt.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you come into your next, you know, new thing that you haven't seen before, you can draw analogies to the patterns that you've got in your tool belt. And you could say that's one. I recognize this. This is a customer first pattern in his case.
Right. Patterns are not theory. You don't say, I'm going to invent a pattern. Let me see what I can invent, and then just coin a term and then say, and we're going to start doing this pattern. It's always something that you've been doing before. Other people, you know, have been doing before. And, you know, it could be years old, but just no one's ever come up with a term for it yet to communicate it succinctly. And so you finally figure out, man, we've been doing this. Everyone understands these techniques, but we need a name to communicate this stuff.
You know, you stole one of my questions, because I was actually going to ask you, do you think patterns are invented or they're discovered?
Well, the name for a pattern has to be coined.
Right.
But as far as the techniques that embody that, well, it's a mix. I mean, I think someone just needs to have a reflection, and then you could say someone discovers that they've been doing the same thing over and over and over and over again.
Yeah,
and then they realize, wait a minute, I need some way to communicate this. And so they just come up with a term for it.
Yeah, I think the patterns have always existed. It's just, you know, we now have kind of codified it with a kind of cool name.
Yeah.
And Dave Boston and I talk about this, my co-host, all the time, that, you know, I invented RESTful Web Services 4 years before the term was ever, you know, coined.
Yeah.
Right? I made the fatal mistake of not giving it a cool name. like rest, right? Because I would definitely, I wouldn't be, you know, humping around to .NET user groups at, you know, 10 o'clock at night, you know, if I had invented rest, right? But I was doing rest, you know, and I think a lot of people were doing it. And the example, so that's my personal one, because I'm more of a web service backend kind of guy. Dave talks about how he was doing Ajax 6 years before they ever coined the term Ajax. You know, and along comes a guy, and I think he had actually, you know, coined the term in the shower, is the famous story, right? That he was looking at what to call this, and he actually said, "Oh, Ajax, that's a good one."
Just like .NET Rocks was a podcast before they were called podcasts.
Absolutely. So, you know, there's a lot of patterns. And you mentioned the Gang of Four, and the Gang of Four is a reference to a book written by four authors, and I can't rattle off their names.
Eric Gamma et al.
There you go. You know, and so the Gang of Four is famous because they kind of, you know, define, like, you know, here's a set of patterns that, that have been out there for a while, and we're just going to give, you know, names to them. We're going to explain, you know, them. So there's been patterns going back, you know, 40, 50 years, how long have we been in computing? I guess I should get to a question here. Scary that I haven't, that I'm rattling on this far, but Jeffrey, what's your favorite pattern?
My favorite pattern, that's interesting, favorite pattern.
And I have a dollar as to what you're going to answer. I've got a bet going on this one, so.
Probably the specification pattern.
Really? So, I haven't known you terribly long. We met last year. We've talked a couple times, and I actually thought that you were going to say, this was my dollar bet. The one that's working for me right now, because you're a true pragmatist, you know. But tell us about the specification pattern.
Well, the specification pattern is really good for searching. And essentially, it says that you have an object that represents what you're looking for. And so you have an object that specifies criteria of what you're looking for. And I can't rattle off the problem statement wrote by memory, but I find myself using this for searches a lot because you have your simple search by username or search by key or one off things, and that's pretty easy. However, I've done quite a lot of things that have really, really advanced search criteria, or the criteria for looking for particular set of objects could be far-reaching, and so there needs to be some generic way to specify what you're looking for, because you could be looking by all kinds of different criteria. And so by using the specification pattern, you can create an object that encapsulates the knowledge of what you're looking for. And so say I have a repository interface that I'm looking for customer objects. Well, I need to somehow pass in what I'm looking for. Now, if it's simple, hey, get customer by username. Okay, that's easy enough. But
yeah,
get customer where max order is greater than 10 million, or get customer where last two orders in a row were late on payment, or, I mean, all kinds of weird criteria. We can create an object that is able to encapsulate all that behavior or all that information, and just pass the object into the search method, and you know, have a really good interface contract for that search.
Yeah, I think you know, in the 90% case, searches, you know, and the vocabulary are very easy. You get into some pretty complicated ones, like I was frustrated with several search engines today. I actually tried, you know, all three of the major varieties, you know, the Google, the Live Search, the, you know, the Yahoo, because what I was trying to do was...
But did you try webcrawler.com?
No, I didn't. No. But my issue was I needed to be able to express negative, right? Like, I put in several search terms, and I put in a site, right? So I said, search this site for these terms.
Yeah.
But I don't want anything ending in PDF, and I don't want anything.
Right.
What I really wanted was, and I'll change my example so you don't know what I was searching for. Not that I was doing anything, you know, unseemly or anything. But, you know, the classic example is, you know, Ford, right? Henry Ford and Gerald Ford. you know, what I really wanted to say was, don't give me any search results where Henry is within, you know, two white spaces of Ford. So that way I can throw away all of those, you know, those irrelevant ones about Henry Ford, because I'm looking for Gerald Ford and what he did for economics, not what Henry Ford did.
Right. Yeah, the closest I can think of is you put a minus before the search term in Google, and it excludes all the results that include whatever term that is.
Yeah.
But within a certain proximity, I've never seen.
Yeah, see, that's the blunt sword, right, is don't give me anything with the word Henry. Well, Henry Kissinger, you know.
Right.
Wow, this is a pretty poignant example that I've got, you know. Let's just say that's what I was searching for today.
Right.
You know, so that's kind of a cool pattern. Tonight you were talking about the NVC pattern, which I think is on a lot of people's minds right now, because it's kind of
can't imagine why.
It's kind of been brought to the forefront because Microsoft's going to do an implementation, and as you said, X number of years overdue. And I don't remember what you said. You know, 5, 10, 20.
Long overdue. I mean, Microsoft's the last to the table with a MVC framework for web applications. All the other major platforms have, if not one, several. Now the .NET platform does have an MVC implementation, and it's Castle Monorail. And my company's put that into production, and we love it. It works great, and a lot of other folks have too. But because it's not for Microsoft, you know, it has a pretty good usage numbers. But of course, there's just tons of people in this industry who won't use something unless it's from Microsoft.
Well,
that's a shame.
Yeah, there's an obvious hurdle there. And that's the fact that, you know, out of the box, you know, Visual Studio doesn't come with it, right?
Yeah,
so
exactly.
you've got to like, you know, go download it. I know that there's, I mean, I personally, before I came to Microsoft, I was an architect working for an insurance company, and I had a lot of conversations with my CIO because he'd put out a blanket, no open source, and Monorail and Castle, you know, definitely fall into the open source camp.
Yeah. So a lot of companies are doing that. So why did you come to Microsoft?
Why did I come to my... are you turning the tables on me, Jeffrey?
Just an innocent question.
You know, I had worked for 4 years as an enterprise architect, you know, at this insurance company, and loved my job. And it's funny, when I interviewed for Microsoft, you know, I'll call him out by name, but Josh Holmes actually said, you know, well, if this doesn't work out, where are you going to go? And I said, well, I'm going to stay at my job. I love my job. You know, this is an opportunity for me to do something that I'm really passionate about. I had an issue that as an enterprise architect, I was becoming less and less technical as time went on. I remember, you know, my skill sets were, I mean, I was a comm master. Man, you talk about, yeah. like I could quote, you know.
Comm is love.
I could show up Ted Pattison implementing, you know, com objects in VB6. And the longer I was away from the development side of things, you know, as an enterprise architect doing, you know, more Word documents than, you know, code, you know, the technology kind of slipped on me. And I saw Microsoft as a good opportunity to get a little more technical.
So you're an architect evangelist now, is that right?
Yeah.
So what does that mean? What do you do as an architect evangelist?
So evangelist, I mean, our general, and you are interviewing me now, so, but that's okay. It's a good question. An evangelist, I think our job is, and by the way, you know, Jeffrey, whether you know it or not, you're an evangelist for Microsoft. You're what we like to call an unpaid evangelist, you know,
exactly.
So we give you a nice title like MVP or RD or whatever. And, you know, we give you a great conference in April, but, you know, there are a lot of evangelists that don't actually work for Microsoft. I happen to be lucky to be one of the few that does, you know, work for Microsoft.
But I didn't have to sign a public relations restrictions agreement.
I did? Did I? Okay. I assigned so much on my first day. You know, we're about creating passion around the platform. And honestly, there's a lot of people that accuse evangelists of being salespeople. But, you know, I personally see myself as an advocate for the platform, which is something you can't buy, right? I mean, you know, the .NET framework, we ask that you license the, you know, the software that it's running on. But the framework itself is free. You know, I'm the sales guy for the products you can't buy. So Silverlight, we have a great sales force in the field that works with our enterprise and small and medium customers to actually talk about the value of the products that you buy. I'm there to create passion about the products that you can't buy. Now, that's the one half. That's the evangelist side. But the architect is specifically, you know, architects think a little different than developers many days.
Yeah.
And as somebody who's been a practicing architect, I can have conversations, you know, through analogy of like, oh, yeah, I've been there with you, that my developer evangelist counterparts can't have. And it's just it's just us recognizing that the architect audience is significant enough that we should spend some time, some investment, you know, with them.
You know, you're only the second architect evangelist that I've ever met. Met plenty of developer evangelists. There's only a second AE. So that's interesting.
And the first is it Phil?
The first was Philip Wheat.
Yeah.
He's in Austin, Texas. He helps out the Austin.net user group and Agile Austin. He opens up the Microsoft sales office down there and gives all the assistance that he possibly can. So really appreciated.
Yeah.
But I've met tons of developer evangelists, but is the AE program growing these days?
So it's about, if you look at, you know, Microsoft evangelist in the United States, can't speak for, you know, the whole world, but it's about 50-50 between architect evangelist and developer evangelist. The difference is that we have two different flavors of architect evangelist. We have a group that's focused specifically on working with big customer accounts, what we call our enterprise product group, EPG accounts. You know, that's the big companies. And they do, behind the corporate door, you know, close relationships with them. And, you know, so they develop a deep relationship. They work closely on a company by company. Phil and myself, and there's a couple other guys now in the United States. Brian Prince out of Columbus, Ohio is another one. Clint Edmondson out of St. Louis. We are community-focused architect evangelists. You're familiar with developer evangelists because they're working with the .NET user groups.
Right.
You know, they're, you know, you see them present, you know, at, you know, our events and, you know, third party events like bar camps and things like that. Microsoft is so committed to the AE audience that they're said that, you know, hey, we need to do broad reach in here. Because it's interesting that I've had this conversation with, you know, our management at Microsoft about the fact that, you know, the reason to pay, you know, close attention to the architect audience is fundamentally everybody who writes code, you know, is an architect at some level.
Right.
It's kind of scary.
Beware the non-coding architect.
Yeah. Yeah. Well. That's a whole other conversation. And one of the reasons that I said, you know, like, hey, I need to, you know, get close to the code personally myself. But with the lack of architecture, with a lack of thought, every line of code, you're defining the architecture.
Right. Even at the highest level, some enterprise architects are really, they're IT strategists. If they're looking at it from the highest view possible, you know, they might not write any individual system, but they still must know intimately how those systems are communicating with the others and what those communication protocols are and synchronous, asynchronous. And still understand it in order to set responsible IT strategy.
Oh, absolutely. I actually have I've got a series of posts on my blog right now called Architecture by Baseball. And it's kind of a reach, okay?
Yeah.
But, you know, I compare...
So that's an architectural pattern?
I guess so, yeah. What I've done is I've identified things in the sport of baseball. And I'm a big baseball fan myself. So that's why I'm really passionate about this series. Things about baseball that you can apply to software architecture. Like I talk about the role of coaches in baseball. Because coaches are unique because it's the only sport. Baseball is the only sport where the coach is allowed on the field. And that's what the architect should be like. They shouldn't, you know, even if they have a different role than the developers, they should be on the field. They wear the same uniform, you know, as the players. But the one specific that's so, you know, your comment made me think about is in baseball, there's a thing called a five-tool player.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, you know, the five essential skills, you know, in baseball are hitting for power, hitting for average, speed on the base path, catching and, throwing. And I actually came up with a, here's the five essential tools of the software architect. And one of those is software development. Even if you're not writing the code, you have to understand how to write code and the limitations of that.
Or how about coach the developers how they should be constructing the code?
Absolutely. You know, and that ties back to the role of the architect as a coach. You know, I would say that, you know, as a good architect, you're probably, and maybe, and you know, that's essentially what you do, Jeffrey. You probably only spend 30% of your time or less actually in there sketching out, like, here's what the application, you know, should look like, and, you know, designing it. You spend 70% or more of your time making sure that you're, you know, the people that are writing the code understand how to implement it, coaching them, mentoring, working with them to make the system work.
Right. So what's corresponds with running a base in the architecture by baseball?
I think that would, so as I can, and I don't have my blog open in front of me, but I said that you had to, as an architect, you had to understand process. You have to understand software development. Communication, I think, is the fundamental, you know, the block and tackle skill for the architect. Because as the architect, really your job is to bridge the business audience and the technical audience. And the most successful architect is the one who's going to be comfortable communicating with both of those audiences. Usability, I saw was another important skill for the architect. That's probably the running the bases one, mm-hmm. right? Because you can get around the bases in a sloppy, haphazard, you know, fashion. You know, if you run the bases elegantly and you develop, you know, an elegant user experience, not a user interface.
Right.
But if you understand, you know, how people are going to use the system, that's kind of the running the bases.
Right.
Wow. We should turn this back on you and talk a little bit more about patterns of Palermo.
Where were we?
we were talking about MVC, and you got a book coming up on MVC, and I have no problem with people, you know, plugging their book on the Thirsty Developer. You know, why is that the one book that I should buy about the, you know, ASP.NET MVC framework?
Well, it's probably not the one book you should buy. The title
excellent answer.
The title is ASP.NET MVC in Action, and it's by Manning. And
I got to tell you, I'm really impressed with Manning as a publisher. I'm actually reviewing a book for another author, and even the attention they pay to the reviewers, you know, shows you a lot about their publishing process.
Well, good. My co-authors are Ben Sherman and Jimmy Bogard, and both of them have some pretty popular blogs. And essentially, our audience is what we think sets us apart in the book market, because we know that there's going to be books. Saying, here's what it is at the most basic level. Here's how to get started using it. We have a very, very narrow audience, but I think there's a lot of people that fall into this area, and that is for the advanced developer who already intimately understands ASP.NET, and they're wondering how to use the MVC framework, why they should use it, when they're putting in their system, where should it go, what they should not do, what they should do. And so in line with that, we're not even going to tell you how to create a new project, because you're already going to know that. We're not going to tell you the basics of collections, the basics of data access, or any other regular .NET topic, because you already know that. What you really want to know is, what layer does this fit into? And the answer is presentation layer. How is it different than web forms usage of ASP.NET? And
how is it similar?
Similar? Exactly. Yeah. What exactly changes? Because essentially, the MVC framework only splits off because a different IHTTP handler is handling the request. The whole ASP.NET pipeline is still executing there.
Yeah, and I don't think we as Microsoft demonstrate that properly. I mean, we always want to make, you know, the new shiny thing, you know, this fantastic thing, and I don't think that we show how familiar it is to people.
Yeah, and that's probably why the Microsoft platform is so popular, because all the all the communication is geared to how easy it is to get started as a .NET developer. So there's a lot of people who get started as .NET developers, but our book is hopefully going to help propel that forward instead of just, oh, here's how to get started with the MVC framework. Because we're going into topics like dependency injection, separation concerns, test-driven development, interface-based design, onion architecture, how to use attributes, the action filter attributes to compose your logic, how to compartmentalize the logic, presentation model versus domain model, a lot of things that you'll probably have to go and look up some concepts that you're not familiar with, but we are actively shunning beginner level topics in the book and trying to make an advanced book that you'll keep around instead of flipping through and then just collecting dust on your shelf.
Yeah, and as you said, that you'll probably need another book that's just the reference book, sitting on the shelf next to it.
Well, those books are already there. Working Effectively with Legacy Code by Michael Feathers, Domain Driven Design by Eric Evans, Patterns of Enterprise Application Architecture by Martin Fowler. There's tons of great books out there, and we're referencing the concepts in a lot of those books and then bringing them together with the techniques that we show in ASP.NET MVC in Action.
So there's a lot of things that you mentioned, when you're describing the book, and one of my favorites is the onion architecture. We don't have time to go into it in the podcast right now, and I do want to thank you for your time thus far. Can you tell people what your blog is so maybe they can go look at some of the stuff? I know you've got some great write-ups on, everything that you just listed.
Yeah, jeffreypalermo.com is the blog, and if you just Google Jeffrey Palermo, the first, 54 links on Google, and the onion architecture is just pulling together a lot of concepts that a lot of folks are already doing, nothing new, but pulling them together, trying to come up with a term that can be used to describe all these collectively. And at the heart is a core object model and dependency injection that brings it all together. So this architecture actually requires an IOC container, at least in the .NET space. JeffreyPalermo.com. I got three parts to the series so far, and I plan on continuing it.
Great. Well, I want to thank you for being on The Thirsty Developer, and thank you for your time tonight.
Thank you very much.
So what did you think of the interview, Brian?
You know what? I think it was really good because I think Jeffrey has a great you guys started talking about patterns and practices, and he has a really down-to-earth view of that, and I think a lot of folks and a lot of listeners might not really get the whole idea and what it means to developers. So he really put it in perspective for a lot of people.
Yeah, I think that Jeffrey is the ultimate pragmatist.
Yeah.
He's definitely going to adopt something that makes him more productive. He's definitely going to avoid the things that don't. And he's got a lot of insight to share. And we had just started going with the interview. I swear we could have gone an extra hour. Wow. But actually, it was cut out of the final edit, close to a half hour into it. The waiter came over to the restaurant we were at and said, you guys got to leave. We closed half an hour ago.
Oh, my gosh. Nice. They booted by the restaurant. Nice.
They actually were pretty nice, up until that point, of not, doing the rude things to get rid of people. But,
right.
But yeah, it was a good time. We barely scratched the surface on everything with Jeffrey. But check out his blog. Check him out if you're in the Austin area. He's also doing a tour of .NET user groups right now. He'll probably do another one in the future. Most importantly, I'm looking forward to the party with Palermo at the PDC.
Yeah, absolutely. That's where I first kind of, which is really unfortunate, but heard of Jeffrey as in such a wide audience as these the Palermo parties that he throws at these big events, which is just wildly attended. People love him, and they're great social networking events that kind of either are prior or follow our big technical events. So you have to go check it out if you haven't.
So what's funny is that I've been to one of these and didn't see Jeffrey there at all.
It's just the name that makes it, right?
Yeah, and I remember it was one where Scott Hanselman actually, video conferenced in, so everybody talked to Scott, via the video conference. But,
nice.
But we didn't. I don't remember ever running into Jeffrey that night. So
yeah, he may or may not have even been there. You never know.
I think he was there, but
probably.
So should we move on to the blog you should know?
Yeah, absolutely.
What you got for us?
I have my blog that you should know is J.D. Meyer, and in keeping with the theme of the podcast, J.D. is a principal program manager at Microsoft in our Patterns and Practices group, and he has a a great blog that talks about not just technical patterns and practice, but I think his last post is 10 success patterns for program managers. And you can find him at blogs.msdn.com/J Meyer. Let me spell it for you just because it has a little bit different of a spelling for the last name. So blogs.msdn.com/JMEIER.
It's great. It's a good blog. So my blog, you should know this week, is actually a buddy of yours. It's Chris Woodruff's blog.
I know Chris.
Yep. And the URL is blog.cloudsocket.com. You know, it's spelled just like it sounds. If you go to cloudsocket.com, it's actually, you know, his actual website. I think it's a .NET Nuke site or whatever. Mm-hmm. But Chris has got a pretty interesting blog. He's got, you know, of course, the, you know, here's what's upcoming kind of things. But what really caught my eye, I've you know, been, you know, burning his blog for about 6 months now or whatever. Mm-hmm. He had this great post on looking at the Apollo 13 mission and the success and failure criteria that they ran into and how to apply that to software development.
Oh, very nice. Very nice. I haven't seen that yet. I'll have to check it out.
Yeah, check it out. It's really good. You know, very thoughtful. And I think that a lot of people, I for one had, you know, heard about and, you know, had done a lot of reading on the Apollo 13 mission before the movie came out. But I think a lot of people would be familiar with it because of the movie.
Right. Yeah, that's how I would be.
Yeah, as part of the post, he's got this great picture of Ed Harris actually drawing at the chalkboard. And he's actually, you know, kind of annotated it, you know, with his, you know, photo editing tool. And it's a really, you know, insightful read. And it only takes you a couple minutes to read. It's not like it's a huge post or whatever. But, yeah, Chris is a good guy. He actually runs a podcast as well. And I think a lot of our listeners are probably also listeners of his podcast. If you haven't checked that out, it's Deep Fried Bites. It's a co-project, kind of like Dave and I's Thirsty Developer. It's with Keith Elder.
Okay.
And, you know, they have a Southern-flavored style to the podcast.
That's Keith, all right.
I ran into a little bit of a conflict with Chris and Keith over the podcast because they were talking about adult beverages, about beers. Mm-hmm. And I was like, whoa, you guys are crossing into the Thirsty Developer.
That's right.
I didn't like their pick. You know, of beers. They were talking about this local Michigan beer.
Oh, come on.
Called Bell's. And actually, no, Bell's is great. But they were talking about the Oberon being the best beer. And I sent them a Twitter message, and I said, hey, guys, sorry. The Two-Hearted Pale Ale is the best Bell's beer.
That's right. So you knew all about that. You had to school them on that.
Yeah. So check out Deep Fried Bites podcast. We'll put that in the show notes, of course. And with that, I think we'll go ahead and wrap up the show for the week.
Great. Sounds good.
Yeah. And for all our listeners, we invite you to comment on each and every show at thirstydeveloper.com. For general show information, send an email to thirstydeveloper@live.com. And I promise I will check it a little more often than I have been. I actually went out there the other day and there was a couple of emails. And I went, ooh, you know, first thing I did was apologize to people. But they gave us a couple of great show ideas, also some things they'd like to see about the show. You can reach Brian and myself. We both have blogs. BrianGorbett.com, LarryClarkin.com. You can reach us on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn. We'll put all that in the show notes. So with that, we'll call it a week.
Sounds good. Sink, sink, sink.
You totally don't have to do that.
What are we sinking? We're not over the phone. It's on the Sink Podcast.